Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. There are more signs that the recession is easing. The latest numbers on GDP, new home sales, and orders for big-ticket items like cars and appliances offer some hope that the worst might be over. But jobless numbers are still troubling, and consumers are continuing to hold back on spending. Joining me in the studio to talk about the outlook for the U.S. economy under the newly reappointed chairman, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, the American Enterprise Institute's Kevin Hassett, Alice Rivlin of the Brookings Institution, and Eamon Javers of Politico. Welcome to you all. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Good to be here. You
can join our conversation, as always. Please do. 1-800-433-8850, drshow@wamu.org is our email address. And, of course, we're also on Facebook and Twitter. Let's talk about the good news first, Alice. Orders for durable goods up a bit, new home sales, positive number. This morning, GDP numbers down only 1%, apparently qualifies as good news since it was less drastic downturn. What's going on here?
Well, the basic news is it's not getting worse as fast as it was before. Mm-hmm. And that means there's hope that we will get to the bottom quite quickly and the economy will begin growing slowly again. And there are some signs that the housing market is bottoming out also, as they say. Prices are beginning to rise in most major metropolitan areas, which is good news. And a few other things, as you say, durable goods. But let's not go overboard here. Mm-hmm. We're in a very deep recession. Unemployment is still rising, is likely to continue to rise well into 2010, over 10%. So this is the worst recession that we've had since the early 80s and probably worse than that one. And it's a very serious situation still.
And Kevin Hassett, one other cause for judicious reactions here is that you've had at least two federal programs that have been aimed at boosting these two sectors that have rebounded. You had the first-time credit for home buyers and the Cash for Clunkers program, which clearly had an effect on auto sales. So that also raises the question, will these recoveries be sustainable after these subsidies fade away?
Well, I think that they will in part because if you go back and look at the stimulus program, most of those stimulus monies that weren't actually spent on checks to people or the Cash to Clunkers program haven't really gone out yet. And so there's going to be a significant government stimulus going forward, I think, for a few quarters. I would say, adding to the optimistic signs that Alice mentioned, there are a few others that are worth noting. One is that the rest of the world seems to be doing a lot better. There are portions of Asia that are growing in the double digits again. Europe, there are a couple of countries, France and Germany, posted positive growth in the second quarter. I think that it's almost certain that the third quarter for U.S. GDP will show positive growth, in part because inventories are going to be rebuilding. And so we are at a turning point. The question is, are we going to have another turning point in the opposite direction at some point in the future when we start to pay the bills for these things?
Now, Eamon, one of the key variables here is consumer confidence. Drives about 70% of the economy, consumer spending. And you had an uptick. The Conference Board, this organization in New York, which measures consumer confidence, reported this week. It was up on their scale to 54. That's about double what it was at the bottom, but still about 90 or 100% number in that scale is considered robust. So we're still way below. Talk about the role of consumer confidence, and is this coming back?
Well, it's absolutely crucial, but more important than consumer confidence is consumer spending. Mm-hmm. And confidence confidence generates spending. But the American consumer, by and large, has been completely shell-shocked by this recession. I mean, they really took a beating with unemployment and all the scary figures and the wipeout that we saw in the stock market. People's retirements are down. Their home values are down. Americans don't feel wealthy anymore, and that's really going to hurt consumer spending for a long time to come. I think there's been a real psychological shift in this country away from the personal debt accumulation that we saw and towards spending, and that's probably a good and responsible thing for Americans to do, but in the short term, it makes it really hard to drive a recovery based on spending.
There is an irony here, because during the bubble years, there was this enormous concern that Americans were not saving enough.
Right.
They were living beyond their means. They were maxing maxing out their credit cards.
And they were.
And now people are concerned that they're saving too much because that means that they're not spending.
Yeah, that's right. And so the irony here is that in the global economy, which was led for so many years by the American consumers' plastic credit cards, now, you know, we might see a global economic recovery led, as Kevin said, by the Europeans or by the Asians or by somebody else. Ultimately, that's probably good for the U.S. to not be in the position of having our consumers driving the entire global economy. But it might be a long road to recovery.
And Alice, I want you to talk about something you mentioned earlier, which is the unemployment rate. Even while there was some good news, we're now familiar with the argument that unemployment is a lagging indicator. But this week, the Congressional Budget Office and the Council of Economic Advisors in the White House, the Congressional Budget Office, which you once headed, admitted that unemployment now at 9.3, 9.4 will probably go over 10. Why is this lagging behind, and how serious is that a factor?
Well, I'm not sure the word is admitted. They projected unemployment will continue to rise. That's standard in a recession. Mm-hmm. When employers lay off people in a recession, they are reluctant to take them back on until they're sure that they really need them. So they even work their existing employees harder in the beginning of a recovery so that they don't have to hire more people. And then the other thing is people who had dropped out of the labor force, they just gave up. They were looking for a job, couldn't find one, decided to do something else. Those people come back into the labor force quite
quickly. And they're counted again.
And they're counted again. So that makes it harder for unemployment to go down.
And all of these things link together. And the question of consumer spending that Eamon was talking about directly also linked to these unemployment numbers, because if people are worried about losing a job, worried about getting another job, that's going to have an effect on consumer confidence.
Well, that's absolutely right. But before we do too much bemoaning of the consumer holding back, we have to recognize that I wouldn't call this an irony so much as coming to our senses. American consumers were spending beyond their means greatly. That was not sustainable. Now we've got to come back to an economy that is more sustainable, in which people save more and we finance more investment out of our domestic saving.
Kevin, bottom line here, as Alice used the phrase, bottoming out. There's a lot of analysis going on, trying to say, has the recession hit its low point? You talk to a lot of economists. You're an economist yourself. What's your best estimate? What's the consensus view here?
I think the consensus view is that the third quarter is going to be positive. And that's
and that would
and
indicate
so we're going to start, and that would indicate that it could be the turning point. But you know, if some other Wall Street firm suddenly explodes in November or something like that, it could be that it's a short respite and that the recession will continue. I would guess that it's probably a slightly better than even money bet that ultimately the NBR will say that the recession ended around August.
Now, there was also major economic news this week, Eamon, on the question of the deficit this year and then the long-term debt, and some absolutely stunning numbers coming out of both the Congressional Budget Office and the White House Budget Office. $1.6 trillion in debt in this fiscal year. Actually, that's a slight decrease in the estimate for technical reasons. But an accumulated debt over the next 10 years of $9 trillion. What's behind these staggering numbers?
Well, this is a case where it might be appropriate to use the word admitted. I mean, the Obama administration came out and admitted that earlier in the year when they were putting together their forecasts, they were using data that didn't quite capture the severity of the recession. They didn't know
they admitted that
how bad it was. They admitted that. And they said, you know what? We got the projections wrong 6 months ago. Now we're going to say that we're looking at $9 trillion worth of debt over 10 years as opposed to 7, and that's entirely because the recession was much worse than they thought, and that affects how much revenue the government collects and also affects how much automatic spending the government has to do. So that said, we're getting a real picture of just how ugly this recession was and that it probably is the worst recession since the Great Depression.
But also, Alice, about two-thirds of that deficit for this fiscal year comes from two huge spending programs, the stimulus program that Kevin mentioned at $787 billion, and then the bailouts of major financial institutions at another $700 billion. There's also a pretty large consensus, despite these staggering numbers, that those efforts were essential.
I agree that they were essential, and they're also temporary. Mm-hmm. Those huge, staggering numbers for the annual deficit will go down as those programs terminate. But the long-run picture is ugly. It's mm-hmm. been ugly for a long time, and now it's gotten worse. Mm-hmm. But substantially, the out-year deficits, as they say, 10 years from now and beyond that, those are not driven by these recession-related expenditures and the lack of revenues. Those are driven by the fact that we made two big promises to our older citizens under Social Security and especially Medicare and Medicaid, and those promises are coming due down the road. That's not new news. People like me have been saying this for a long time.
And all those people who are going to get Social Security, Medicare, they've already been born. This is not guesswork.
Oh, yes. That's
right. We know who they are.
They're right in this room. We know who they are. And we also know that medical spending, health care related spending, is rising more rapidly than any other kind of spending. Put all that together, and you've got a serious long run situation.
One of your successors at the CBO, Doug Elmendorf, this week called these numbers unsustainable. You agree with his word?
Absolutely. But they've been unsustainable for a long time. That's not new news.
Okay, that is Alice Rivlin. She is at the Brookings Institution. Eamon Javers covers economics and politics for Politico, and Kevin Hassett is with me. He's at the American Enterprise Institute. I'm Steve Roberts. I'm sitting in today for Diane. We're going to be back with your calls and your comments. We've got some lines open. Call us at 1-800-433-8850. drshow@wamu.org is our email address. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Our subject this hour, the economy and all the news that's been made this week, various reports, various indexes coming in, some good, some bad. Kevin Hassett of the American Enterprise Institute is with me. So is Alice Rivlin of the Brookings Institution, Eamon Javers of Politico. Kevin, Alice was just describing, and Eamon too, these enormous numbers, $1.6 trillion in this fiscal year, as much as $9 trillion in accumulated debt over the next 10 years. What practical effect does this have on the economy?
Well, I think the first thing is that the government has got to tax us in order to pay the interest on all that debt, and that interest has gone up in the hundreds of billions every year. And so that's going to make it harder to do things like, say, a healthcare program, because the money that we maybe could have allocated to that is going to have to be allocated to interest. And it's going to increase the pressure to raise taxes next year when a lot of the tax cuts are going to be renegotiated. I would guess that there'll be pressure to extend fewer of the Bush tax cuts than maybe the Democrats mm-hmm. would like, because their revenues are really going to be in demand. The thing is that a government can get by running an unsustainable policy for a while. But eventually, at some point, what happens in other countries is that there starts to be a crisis in confidence in that government's debt. And so it's very common, frankly, in world history for countries to default on their debt. And the way a default happens is they show up on Monday morning and they try to sell some debt and nobody wants to buy it. And very rarely do you see that coming. And I don't think anyone thinks that that's exactly the path the U.S. is going to head down. But we run the risk of igniting a panic about U.S. debt if we continue to run an unsustainable policy.
And Eamon, the people who hold that debt, China number one, Japan number two, a lot of this debt is in the hand of foreign creditors. So the question of confidence is a very important one.
It's absolutely important. And what we've got here is a government that in many ways is sort of dependent on the kindness of strangers. And that's not a good position for any government to be in because it limits your flexibility in terms of the world economy and world politics. We are dependent every time that the Treasury Department goes out to auction off new treasuries. That's how the government borrows. We sell treasury bills to investors, and a large percentage of those go to overseas investors. Every one of those auctions are being watched very, very carefully right now because we are sort of in scary, uncharted waters here in terms of the amount of debt that we're issuing. Is there a buyer for all this debt? So far, there has been, and so far, it looks good. We can get away with this, but if the buyers don't show up, it could be very, very bad.
And one of the things, Alice, is the interest rates we have to pay for that debt. If buyers start losing some confidence, they might still be willing to buy this debt, but they will demand higher interest rates, and that could have inflationary pressures on the economy.
Absolutely, and it could reduce the value of the dollar. But we're in a strange situation. Mm-hmm. It's sort of counterintuitive. But in this crisis, when everybody was panicked about the financial stability of the world, what did investors do? They bought U.S. treasuries. Mm-hmm. And that drove the interest down. Mm-hmm. Kevin was mentioning the future cost of interest. It could be much higher if those interest rates go up. Right now, they're extraordinarily low because the world has not lost confidence in the U.S. government.
And the Chinese government has raised the question of trying to create some kind of special currency that would not be tied to the dollar, that would allow them to find an alternative to investing in dollars as in their holdings. But as you say, so far, even China has continued to show confidence in the American economy and put a lot of its money. I think they bought $25 billion worth of treasuries last week.
They have indeed. They are making noises about the future and being less confident. But they don't have all that many alternatives. Mm-hmm. They could put it in euros, but Europe, while recovering a little faster perhaps than we are, doesn't look like the great hope of the future. Ultimately, they will want to invest in their own economy and grow it so that they become a stronger consumer society than they are at the moment. But that may take time.
And one of the implications here of these numbers, as you mentioned earlier, Kevin, the other enormous debate happening in Washington now on hold sort of for a week or two, but will come back with great ferocity and after Labor Day is the debate over health care. And this week you saw Republican leaders using these numbers to argue that the price tag on the president's health care bill was about roughly estimated at $1 trillion, although he says it will be paid for. But the Republican argument is crystallizing that these numbers indicate that the health care bill is too expensive. It's going to be a major factor in this debate in the fall.
Yeah, but we have to also remember that's kind of a theater that we've seen before. Mm-hmm. I've looked at decades of political debates about fiscal things, and generally what you find is that with the exception of the few honorable voices like Alice, who was talking about deficits when she was in the White House, most often it's the opposition party that's wailing about deficits and the party in power that's saying, well, we can wait a year to deal with that. And that's just the way political theater works, because very often the majority party or the party in power is offering something that people might like, whether it's health care or tax reductions. And the opposition party doesn't necessarily want to say, oh, well, you can't have health care, but they can say, oh, my gosh, the deficit. And that's what's going on.
And the Democrats and President Obama would point out, and all of his advisors would point out, that while the Republicans are arguing that the irresponsibility of Obama's policies, that a lot of the cause of these numbers comes from policies from the Republican administration, including, say, a prescription drug benefit, which cost a lot of money and wasn't really paid for.
That's absolutely right.
Let's talk about another economic development of the week, Eamon, and that's the announcement that the president's going to reappoint Ben Bernanke as chairman of the Fed, a Republican, first appointed by President Bush. And in renominating him, the president praised his performance in handling the economic crisis, but also seemed to want a sense of continuity. What was behind his decision?
Well, the timing was unexpected, but the decision was not at this point. I mean, when President Obama was inaugurated back in January, there was some sense that he might want to get rid of Bernanke, who was a Republican appointee, put his own guy in there at the head of the Fed, maybe Larry Summers, who he brought into the White House with him as an economic advisor.
Former Treasury Secretary.
Former Treasury Secretary, exactly. So he had sort of a hip pocket Fed chairman in waiting if he wanted one. But over the course of the 6 months, I'm told that Obama gained more and more confidence in Bernanke, and Wall Street definitely gained more confidence in Bernanke. I'm told that the White House was listening very carefully to the CEOs of major corporations and the folks on the street who said that they thought that Bernanke reappointment would be a gesture toward continuity and stability, and he just didn't want to roil the markets at this point by picking somebody else.
This is always a very important problem for Democratic administrations to have credibility on Wall Street. The previous Democratic President Bill Clinton, of course, had Robert Rubin at his side, who had come from Wall Street. This president doesn't really have, well, he has Timothy Geithner as his Treasury Secretary, who has good reputation on Wall Street. But Democratic presidents always have to pay attention, don't they?
Oh, absolutely, because they can be accused of being sort of soft on the economy. That said, you know, there is something about being a little too close to Wall Street. I mean, you can be seen as doing favors for the big players on the street and ignoring the folks on Main Street. And that's a trope, but that's a balance, too.
Alice, a lot of the comments about Ben Bernanke's reappointment came down to 2 points. One is he made some mistakes before the crisis. He didn't see it coming is a common argument. He was party to the collapse of the Lehman Brothers firm in the fall, which had a big impact. But once the crisis gelled, a lot of people feel he handled it well, as the president mentioned in his reappointment statement. What's your read on Bernanke's record?
I think what you just said is absolutely right. Nobody saw it coming. If that were the criteria for appointing a Fed chairman, we wouldn't have one. I think it would be.
There was one economist, I remember. There was one guy who talked about it.
There
was,
but he said there it every was year Nouriel, for the last 10.
There was Nouriel Roubini.
Yeah.
But nobody saw this coming for an accumulation of reasons. But Ben Bernanke has, in the crisis itself, I think shown both that he understood the problem very well, perhaps partly because he was a student all his life of what happened in the 30s when they did the wrong thing.
One of the world's leading experts on that
yes,
subject.
Yes, absolutely. And also he had the right personality. Mm-hmm. He is a calm, sensible guy. He doesn't panic easily, and he projects confidence and good sense and calm, and that's what they needed.
Kevin, in terms of looking forward in the policies of the Fed right now, as a result of Bernanke's policies in the fall, interest rates have been reduced to virtually zero because the priority has been to stimulate the economy and try to get credit moving. Some of the commentators I've read this week said that there could be a coming clash looking down the road, that if inflationary pressures start to rise, the Fed will be tempted to raise interest rates to control those pressures. But there's also this countervailing pressure to stimulate economic growth. What's your best guess about what's on Bernanke's plate going forward?
Well, I think that the most crucial problem that the Fed has is somehow unwinding all these reserves that they've thrown out there. And so they've been throwing reserves out into the economy, hoping it would stick.
Explain what you mean by reserves.
Well, basically, you could think of it as the checking account at the Fed that banks have. They've been throwing money in there. They've basically been taking, say, mortgage-backed securities and then handing cash to banks. And so the Fed now has a really big balance sheet, much bigger than it usually has. And it has a lot of unusual things on that balance sheet that didn't used to be there. It used to be the Fed balance sheet was treasuries, basically, and it was very liquid. But now they've got stuff that maybe isn't quite so liquid, and the banks have a lot of reserves. And so one thing that the Fed usually does when the economy starts taking off to fight inflation is it'll start selling treasuries to banks and taking some of the cash out of their checking account, which will slow the bank's lending activity down a little bit. Right now, what the Fed has is maybe a bunch of stuff that the banks aren't going to want to buy. And so there's an open question. How is the Fed going to start to restrain lending when the economy really starts to lift off? And the Fed has studied that, that they view that as a crucial problem going forward. But I think that's the main risk. And so I think that probably the biggest risk in the next couple of years is that inflation goes too high because the Fed doesn't have a strong enough brake right now because of the things that it did last year.
But isn't this always an absolutely critical question of how do you strike the right balance between controlling inflation, which can be very damaging to individual families and businesses, but not choking off growth, which you don't want to do. Hitting that sweet spot is the...
You're exactly right. That's exactly the normal question. But the problem right now is that it's a little bit different because the Fed might decide, okay, we're going to be hard. We're going to, even though unemployment's still high, we're so worried about inflation that we're going to crack down. Yeah. And they might not be able to do it as well as they could in the past because they don't have all these liquid treasuries which they can use to get the reserves out.
Alice?
I agree with Kevin that their big problem is unwinding the situation that they're in. But I'm not very worried about inflation. Inflation happens when you've got a lot of demand chasing too few goods. We don't have that situation now. We have overcapacity, not only in this country.
In fact, some people have been worried that inflation hasn't been high enough, that
yes.
you have deflation.
Absolutely. And I actually think that for the foreseeable future, the problem is not inflation. We have overcapacity in this country and around the world. And we have a very flexible economy and a world economy that works very well when there's a shortage of something.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. One more policy question, and then we'll get to our callers, Eamon. Kevin raised earlier the question of the health care debate. And the Republicans, almost unanimous in saying, see, the deficit numbers, the debt numbers show we can't afford health care. Peter Orszag, the head of the budget office this week, argued exactly the opposite is true, that as Alice pointed out earlier, one of the main drivers of the long-term deficit numbers, debt numbers, are rising health care costs. So his argument is we got to spend this money now to be able to grapple with the long-term debt. Walk us through these conflicting arguments.
Well, I'll tell you about the politics of that. I mean, there have been, you know, five or six arguments from the Obama folks through the campaign into the presidency about why we need health care reform. Cost was really low on the list last year. Now it's up to the top of the argument because of the exploding deficit, because of this huge spending. The Obama people have repositioned their argument for health care reform and talk about it now in terms of cost savings as opposed to talking about it in terms of a moral thing that we need to do or in terms of bringing insurance to the uninsured or about these other reasons that you heard more about during the campaign. Now they're talking about cost, and it's because the deficit is a political problem for the Obama administration. The Republicans have really been getting traction in criticizing the administration's spending, and they're realizing they need to pivot a little bit and respond to that. So there's some defensiveness, I think, in the argument.
Alex?
I don't think it's just political, and certainly and that's not fair to Peter Orszag. When Peter Orszag was at the Congressional Budget Office, a nonpartisan position, he was trumpeting the long-term problem of rising costs, and he's not changed his song on that. It's come more into the conversation recently, but it is the big long-run problem that medical spending, health spending, is rising too fast, and we have to do something about it. And the other problem is we don't cover everybody. They're related, but not very related. We have to do something about both.
And one of the problems, Kevin, with this healthcare debate is that there's this basic but often counterintuitive notion that you have to spend money to save money. You have to invest money, say, in electronic records or other kinds of methods, preventive care, screening tests, those sorts of things, which down the road might save money. So this is also partly part of the debate as well.
Yes, and I think, though, that the problem has been related to Alice's last comment, really, in the sense that if it was really just a question of reducing the trajectory of long-run costs, then you could have a bill that's its objective. That's the only thing that it's doing. And then once you succeeded and actually documented that you can reduce those costs or get the trajectory headed in the right direction, then you go after the other objectives. And I think that the big mistake that they've made this time is that they've tried to do it all at once, and it's made people wonder about their credibility when they're talking about costs.
Let me read an email from Bob in Charleston, Illinois. Could your guests consider the present and future future role of the toxic legacy assets still held by banks? Must they be disposed of? How could that be done? Can they be ignored? With what consequences? You were talking about that, Kevin.
Yeah, I think that one of the reasons why, remember we had these, what were they called, the stress tests last spring, that I think really it turns out we're quite successful in turning around confidence about our financial institutions. One of the reasons is that there was this debate about whether the banks should have to mark to market or whether they could count the cash flows from their assets and sort of say, see, our cash flow is positive going forward, so be nice to us. And what the stress test really did is it suspended this mark to market, this idea that their capital requirement is going to be related to the current market value of their assets, and it more or less said
which
we're going
have,
to regulate,
which have plummeted,
which have plummeted, and but the cash flows from the, so there are a lot of, so we know that a lot of people are going to default on their mortgages, but there are a heck of a lot of people still making their monthly payments too,
and most people,
the problem was that there was such a panic about whether everybody was going to default that those assets became kind of almost worthless, and it made the banks basically in violation of every standard of prudence that is imposed to them, but that system that fixed the mark-to-market problem really by passing the stress test has made it so that the toxic asset problem is much reduced because now if an asset has a positive cash flow, then the bank is allowed to continue to hold it.
That's Kevin Hassett from the American Enterprise Institute. Also with me, Alice Rivlin of the Brookings Institution and Eamon Jarvis of Politico. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane. We'll be back with your calls and your comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Going green at home, small changes you can make to conserve energy and reduce your carbon footprint. How conservation and energy efficiency can affect the overall effort to reduce energy demand and carbon emissions. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane today. Our subject, the economy. With me, Kevin Hassett, American Enterprise Institute, Alice Rivlin of the Brookings Institution. And we were just discussing that you should know that Alice was the founding director of the Congressional Budget Office, which has provided a lot of the independent and very valuable numbers that we've been discussing this morning, and Eamon Jarvis from Politico. Let me read this email from Luke in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Doesn't this bad economy all boil down to dropping wages? When people made a lot of money, they spent a lot of money on good services. As wages dropped, they had to get credit cards max out. The only way to long-term stability is increase wages dramatically. Alice?
Well, I think there's some truth in that. Certainly, people did, in an effort to keep up their standard of living, get credit cards and overborrow on their mortgages. Whether that was justified or not, they were certainly being encouraged by the lenders to overborrow. wages weren't actually dropping, but the wages of average people were falling behind the high-income people who were doing extremely well.
And they were fairly stagnant compared to inflation.
And they were stagnant, yes. Over a long period, real wages corrected for inflation have not risen substantially, and the incomes of people at the high end of the scale have grown very rapidly.
Here's an email from Matt Amon, who says, if most day-to-day products are produced in China or other countries, wouldn't heavy consumer spending benefit China and the executives of the companies manufacturing China more than average U.S. citizens? Wouldn't this cause the money to flow out of the country even more?
It would to some extent, but of course, remember that even though the products might be made outside the country, they're sold here, so that there are jobs associated with retailing some of those products. So to some
and
extent,
also with transportation. They land in Seattle, they're sold in Florida, they got to be shipped by somebody.
Right, so a piece of that spending does go to China, but a lot of it stays here in terms of the economic activity that gets that product to the customer. And consumer spending generally will have an impact on the economy.
We saw that with the cash for clunkers. You know, there might be a Toyota that was being sold, but that money still went to a dealer on Main Street and got recycled in the American economy.
Yeah, and the big question with cash for clunkers is whether or not it had any actual impact, or was it just sort of a short-term sugar high for the auto industry? You know, there's one question about whether what we did was we took sales that would have happened in September and October and just moved them into August. And there's another question about whether cash for clunkers, by incentivizing car purchases, actually robbed money from other retail sales. So say you had a little money in your pocket, you were going to go out and get that flat screen TV for football season. Now you said, well, wait, there's a great deal on cars. I'll go spend that money on a car. Maybe what we did with cash for clunkers is just redirected money from the flat screen TV people to the car people.
Let me turn to some of our callers. And Terry in Lorain, Ohio, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, Steve. You do a great job filling in for Diane.
Thank you.
I just wanted a comment and a question. My comment is, I'm just wondering if we're not headed back to where we came from. If people aren't going to go, well, the Dow's up and home sales are up, so everything must be okay, and I go back to my old spending ways, which really isn't, you know, helpful at all. And then my question is, are we using the wrong indicators to validify how our economy is? Just because the Dow's up doesn't mean the guy who put his money into that fund had the money to spend, and just because housing is up doesn't mean the guy can really afford the house he bought.
Okay, Terry, thanks very much. Alice?
Oh, I think there's something in what the caller says. I am a little worried that we will go back to the free spending habits that we had. But remember, we didn't after the Great Depression. After the Great Depression, two generations of Americans, the people who lived through it and their children, were more cautious about spending than they had been before. I think we've learned a lesson this time. I hope so.
I grew up with parents who were children of the Depression, and I can tell you that attitude lasted for many decades.
Right.
Let's talk to Dorothy in Battle Creek, Michigan. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, and I do very much enjoy public radio.
Happy to have you.
When we were talking about increasing the deficit related to the baby boomers coming on to Social Security, I think what, for me, as well, I'm near a baby boomer, what we think is that we paid in all those years. And as we were paying in, and there was an increase in payments in because of the increase in number of people, that money wasn't being invested for us. It was being spent at the time for the needs of the government. And now they're saying that they can't pay us, but they had to get a lot of increased payments at the time the baby boomers were paying into Social Security.
Okay, Dorothy, thank you very much. Kevin, this is a theme I'm getting from some emails as well. Wilma writes to us, what about all the money from the Social Security Fund that the federal government has borrowed for so many years? I have heard time and again that if the money had not been borrowed, the Social Security promise would not be a problem. Answer Dorothy and Wilma.
Yeah. Dorothy's question is a common one. And the fact is that there is this very large Social Security Trust Fund, which is meant to reflect the commitment to people like Dorothy. They paid money in, and there was a big surplus. There's still a surplus in Social Security this year.
Yes.
Those monies, however, very often made space for Congress to go out and waste money on the on-budget side. And the fact is that the Social Security Trust Fund, while a solemn commitment, a sign of a solemn commitment, it's money we owe ourselves. And so it's not the same as having an asset that we can cash in. I would guess that as we look at this tremendous budget mess going forward, that everybody's going to have to contribute some to the solution. And that's going to mean that there's going to be some reneging on the commitment that's visible in the trust.
Well, this relates to something that Alice was saying earlier. It's not just that the cost of health care is going up, but the number of people who would qualify with the retirement of the baby boomers, qualify for retirement assistance is going up. So it's those two demographics coming together, right?
That's absolutely right. And I think we should reassure Dorothy and the other callers, Social Security will pay what is owed to them. But for the long run, it is not going to be solvent because people are living longer and longer. And the commitments were not, it wasn't fully, the amounts paid in wouldn't cover the benefits for the long run. And that's even more true of health care, because what was not anticipated in setting up Medicare was how rapidly the cost of health care per person would go up.
And of course, some of that comes from benefits of new technologies and the ability to keep people alive toward the end of life. There are many social benefits to that, but there are economic costs.
Absolutely. And, of course, other benefits were added, like the prescription drug benefit, which, while imperfect, is still very expensive.
Yeah, when Social Security was set up, I mean, 65 years of age was sort of the end of life,
right,
in terms of life expectancy. Now people retire and spend 25 years on the golf course, you know, and those of us who are not baby boomers, who are coming behind the baby boom, are going to be expected to pay for that.
And I just wanted to circle in on something just that Alice said that I think is a really important reassurance to send out there. And so I was going to say it in a slightly different way. I don't know if Dorothy's retired yet. I think that it's quite likely that in the end, when we start to reform entitlements along the line that Alice has been saying that we should for a long time, what's going to happen is we're going to reduce our promises to people who might retire, say, 10, 15 years from now, but not change the benefits for people who are currently retired. I think most people think that's kind of the way the reform will happen. And so the people who are currently retired, I don't think they should be nervous at all, because everyone, I think, always says their benefits are off the table.
Right.
Let's talk to Marshall in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. It's lovely to be there, and I think you're doing a good job today, too, Steve.
Well,
my questions are twofold. One of them is, if we are going to rebuild the economy, why are we not, or why wouldn't, would it not be better to start making things in the United States rather than importing everything? And the other is, how much of health care expenses goes into supporting insurance companies as opposed to supporting health, and how much equipment do we really need, and how long do I have to live? I mean,
All right, Marshall, two good questions. Let's start with the manufacturing question, Eamon.
Yeah, well, I mean, you hear this a lot from Barack Obama, actually. I mean, he talks a lot in the stimulus spending in particular about getting the real economy back together. He's talking about infrastructure, building things here in this country, the green jobs and green technologies of the future. There's a massive effort by this administration to repoint the economy a little bit back toward manufacturing and infrastructure here in this country.
And one of the key dimensions of that, of course, Alice, is innovation and ideas. It's not just a question of building things that people have already discovered. It's creating new ideas in the information technologies and others. And one of the big issues that this administration is grappling with are visas for foreign engineers and computer scientists and others who provide a lot of those ideas that create jobs and new manufacturing opportunities.
Right. One of the things that this economy is very good at, fortunately for all of us, is innovation and being on the forefront of technology, especially recently in computer and communications technology. We don't grow enough of our own scientists. We should put more money into that. But meanwhile, if we're going to stay on the forefront, we absolutely have to allow the talents of the people educated elsewhere or educated here who want to stay to be used.
I mean, one researcher from Duke said if we keep our current policies of severely limiting the number of foreign visas for foreign scientists, that the next Silicon Valley is going to be in Shanghai or in Mumbai. It's not going to be in California.
Well, look at Google. I mean, it's probably the most important technological innovation of our lifetimes to date, maybe, other than the creation of the Internet itself. Google is one of the founders of that company was an immigrant. And so this country is a magnet for high-talent people from all over the world. That's a real strength of the U.S. economy.
Let's turn to Tim in Dallas, Texas. Welcome, Tim. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you so much. My original question was actually answered by one of the other callers, and so I kind of amended a bit, so I hope you'll bear with me here.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
One of the comments that was made earlier by the one of your panels had said that that we had, in fact, learned our lesson. At least that was the opinion that was made. And although I would love to be optimistic and say that I feel the same way in terms of how our spending habits have possibly changed, I just don't know if I can go there on an emotional level. And the main reason is twofold. We live, obviously, in a different time now than we did back when the Great Depression was there, and two major factors are accountable for that. Number one, there is a very, very, very powerful, impressionable media out there through advertising, et cetera, that wants us to continue spending the same way that we did before, and we seem to have a real easy way of following that media and the advertising. And number two, you know, I live here in Dallas, where a recent newspaper article was written touting us as having the tops in what are called the $30,000 millionaires here. And how that kind of comes to weight to me is that it's almost on a daily basis that I'm continuing to get credit card applications who say I'm pre-approved. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously these companies have got to get new business, and they have to have new spending and new credit being used. So just to kind of reiterate my original point, I'd love to be optimistic, but I'm just afraid that with the times that we live in now versus how we are influenced by the media and everything around us, I just don't know if there's a way that we can truly put our finger on the possibility.
Okay, Tim, thanks very much. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. You were talking about this, so Alice, so answer Tim if you can.
Oh, I share the caller's concern. I think we do need to regulate the credit card excess, and I think we need massive consumer education, starting in the schools, on how to manage your affairs better and not get over indebted.
But as we were saying earlier, it's so often an economic question. You have to find a balance point between two competing trends. And here we were talking earlier that if people don't spend enough, it's not going to re-energize the economy. If they become irresponsible and spend too much, then you get a bubble. So again, it's looking for that perfect balance. It's never going to be perfect, but that good balance between these two impulses.
Absolutely. And that's always the problem for the Federal Reserve and for policymakers generally.
And for individual families.
Right. And well, the caller makes a very good point about the media. They push spending.
Yeah, Kevin?
And I think that there's one other factor that needs to be weighed here, and that is that it's not necessarily the case that in order for America to be more prudent or for American consumers on average to be more prudent going forward, that it means that a lot of people have to change. Because one of the things that drove the problem was easy credit, as the caller mentioned. And I think that that's going to be – so assume, just to simplify, that there are two types of people, people who always pay back whatever they borrow, and then people that – there's a big question whether they will or not. It was a lot easier for the irresponsible people to get money in the past, and I don't think that's going to be as true in the future.
We have time for maybe one more caller, and Greg in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks for your patience. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Greg.
Well, thank you very much. I have a quick comment and then a question.
Go ahead.
I recently read that Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, said that they needed to reduce their tax rate so they could increase jobs and improve the economy and collect more revenue. And I remember that Bill Clinton, when he came in office, got them, our government, to reduce the capital gains taxes. And then I know that during the previous administration, they reduced taxes. And as I recall, the Treasury started having a lot more receipts than they expected, and the deficit was going down. So I did a little bit of research on the effects of tax policy on Treasury receipts, and I'm now more confused than ever because it seems to me, and Ms. Rifkin would certainly be one of the best people to answer this question, if it's true, and of course it may not be, but if it is true that reducing the tax rate for individuals and businesses stimulates the economy, creates more money for the Treasury. Why are we not doing that?
Greg, thank you. It's a very important question that has been debated here in Washington for many years, going back to Ronald Reagan's time when he was an exponent of this economic theory that you lower tax rates and you actually increase revenues. What's your best take on Greg's question?
Unfortunately, the answer is it depends. And it's another balancing act. Reducing taxes does stimulate spending, and all presidents have wanted to do some of that. But it also, unless you reduce the spending of the government, creates more deficit. And that, in the end, for reasons we've talked about, will raise interest rates and make it harder for the economy to grow. So it's a balancing act.
Kevin, your take on this?
Yeah, I think that Alice and I disagree now and then and agree a lot of the time. But I think the one thing that we wish everyone would stipulate is that whatever the government spends, that's how much revenue they have to raise, at least in present value. Maybe not every year, but over time, if we're going to spend $100, then we got to raise $100. And it seems like there are politicians on both sides that don't think that way. There are Republicans who think, well, let's spend $100, but let's tax, only raise $70 in taxes. And then, there are people that are doing the other way. And one side might do it because they want lower taxes, and the other because they want higher government spending. But they need to give that up. They need to pay for what they spend.
That's going to have to be the last word, paying for what you spend. Kevin Hassett of the American Enterprise Institute, Alice Rivlin of the Brookings Institution, Eamon Javers of Politico. Thanks so much for being with us this morning. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and thank you so much for spending part of your morning with us.